Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two segments up today. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Seth Mnookin, author of the book The Panic Virus, on the destructive mythology that's arisen around an imagined connection between vaccines and autism. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear excerpts from an interview I did back in 2006 with my old friend Robert Fitch, who spent a lot of the 60s and 70s in Berkeley, who died on March 4th. Bob was a great thinker and writer, but a way underappreciated one. More on him later. First, just a few words in the economic news. First-time claims for unemployment insurance rose after 2 weeks of decline, but the series remains in a downtrend. As I've been pointing out here for quite a while, the pace of layoffs has been slowing, but the pace of hiring has yet to pick up. I had to record last week's show before the February employment report was released a week ago Friday, so a quick few words on that. The headline gain of 192,000 was the best since May 2010. Manufacturing, surprisingly, is on its best tear, 4 consecutive months of gain in 14 years. But most industrial sectors added jobs, strength that was impressively broad. Still, the gains were pretty much in line with population growth. The employment population ratio, the share of the adult population in paid work, was unchanged for the month. While that ratio is up slightly from its November 2010 low, it's still below where it was in September. At 58.4%, it's more than 6 points below where it was at its all-time high in 2000, and is now at about where it was in 1973. The unemployment rate fell another tenth of a point to 8.9%, its lowest level since April 2009. Hidden unemployment also fell, with the broad U6 rate, which accounts for those working part-time who want full-time work, and those who've given up the job search as hopeless, that fell two-tenths of a point to 15.9%, also its lowest since April 2009. It's still very high, though, nearly twice what it was in early 2007. The Bureau of Labor Statistics publishes data on the flow of people into and out of employment every month. Just 1 in 6 of January's unemployed found a job in February, close to an all-time low for this 21-year-old data series. An enormous number of the unemployed have simply been giving up and dropping out of the labor force. The share of the unemployed dropping out of the labor force entirely has exceeded the share finding work for 2 years now. Much of the recent drop in unemployment comes not from the jobless finding work, but from that slowdown in the rate of job loss I mentioned earlier. So we'll need to do a lot better than this to make a serious dent in unemployment. And while it's nice to see a continuing decline in job loss, it'd be even nicer to see a serious pickup in hiring. Friday morning brought the release of the Job Openings and Labor Turnover Survey, nicknamed JOLTS, for January. It showed a distinct lack of activity in the job market. The level of hires and separations, meaning both voluntary quits and involuntary firings, matched record lows of the series, which goes back about 10 years. Net hiring, hires less separations, was a weak 0.1% of employment. Total job openings fell to just over 2% of employment. That's better than the 2009 average of slightly below 2%, but it matches the rather sluggish 2010 average. There were just over 5 unemployed people for every job opening in January, compared with just under 5 in December. Both those numbers are more about 2.5 times the 2002 to 2007 average. So, the slow recovery continues. People are spending, though. Retail sales were up strongly in February. This looks to be the result of modest improvements in the job market and freer spending at the top of the income distribution. People seem not to be using their credit cards very extensively, though. Luxury goods sales are way ahead of discount and middle market stuff. Plutocracy looks intact. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk vaccines.
Yeah.
stars a bit of the New York Dolls song, Pills. My first guest is Seth Mnookin, author of The Panic Virus, A True Story of Medicine, Science, and Fear, from Simon & Schuster. This is his third book. I first heard of the resistance to vaccine on my old radio station, WBAI, Pacifica's New York affiliate, back in the early 1990s. A woman from Connecticut named Jo Willard did a health show on the station, and one day I tuned in to hear her denouncing vaccinations as ineffective and dangerous. At the time, I was doing weekly commentaries in the late Samori Marksman show, which is the one I got the name Behind the News from. I uncorked a critique of Willard and her dangerous advice. That prompted a retort from WBAI's leading health guru, Gary Null, who believes that HIV doesn't cause AIDS, among other things. Null accused me of ranting and raving without the benefits of research, a quote I still remember, meaning that I didn't share his irresponsible and dangerous position that vaccines cause the disease that they're meant to cure, do more harm than good, and have done nothing to reduce disease since their introduction. That's what Null believes, and like I say, that's dangerous nonsense. So it was with great interest that I took note of Seth Mnookin's new book, which focuses on the alleged connection between vaccination and autism. Autism is a terrible disease, and we don't know where it comes from. We understand the desperation of parents trying to do something about it when their children come down with it. But we do know that autism does not come from vaccinations, and we do know that not vaccinating children puts their lives at risk and the lives of others around them at risk. Already, vaccine shunners have caused an epidemic of measles and 10 deaths from whooping cough in Southern California. As Mnookin says at the end of this interview, not vaccinating your kids isn't just a personal decision. It can kill other people. Okay, here's Seth Mnookin. Welcome, Seth. First of all, let's go into a bit of a history of the vaccination mania. When did vaccinations first become controversial in modern times, and how? I mean, there used to be a great deal of reverence about the things, and then suddenly there was a shift towards skepticism.
Well, I mean, really, apart from the very, very early smallpox inoculation efforts, when the main issue there was that it was such a new medical intervention that people were dubious. But outside of that, what's tended to happen for now over a century is that you get these sort of cyclical patterns where when a disease is endemic in a society, at that point, everyone obviously wants the vaccine and aren't as many of these sort of panics or concerns. And then the more effective a vaccine is, and the more polio or whooping cough or measles recedes into the background, the more that these different fears both crop up and tend to get more traction.
And let's just make that point more explicit. You said that when a vaccine is successful, diseases ebb and sometimes disappear. There are some vaccine opponents who claim that that's not true, that they actually cause diseases they're meant to prevent. But just review for us the history of some of the popular vaccines and what they've done to the disease.
Well, first, I think just to touch on one thing that you said, which I think is really interesting, actually, another sort of line of argument that you hear a lot these days is that the decline in infectious diseases that we've seen in the 20th century is due to things like better sanitation efforts, better city planning, all of those things, and not actually two vaccines. But if you look at the 20th century, the number of different diseases that in countries like the United States and in the UK and in Western Europe have really been conquered, it's remarkable. Polio, obviously, is a huge one and one that probably one of the more famous ones, both because of the polio vaccine efforts in this country, the Salk vaccine, and also because of the March of Dimes, and now we're on the verge of being able to eradicate that worldwide. But, you know, diseases like whooping cough, which can be and continues to be very dangerous and can be fatal in infants, has receded or had receded almost to being non-existent. Right now we're seeing a huge resurgence, and 10 infants died last year in California of whooping cough, which I think should serve as a very stark illustration of how important vaccines continue to be. But, you know, another thing that's really interesting that I hadn't thought of at all until I started this project was how much vaccination has changed other things about the way our society functions outside of just, you know, health and wellness and disease. previous to the widespread vaccination efforts in this country, it was sort of a regularly accepted part of family life that someone, and at that point almost always the mother, was going to need to stay home for several weeks at a time when their children came down with something like chickenpox or measles. And one of the sort of not very well-recognized effects of really the disappearance of a lot of those diseases is that women and mothers had been much freer to enter the workforce. And we had a reminder of how true that is a couple of years ago when there was a measles outbreak in California, and there were dozens and dozens of children who were quarantined. And so dozens of parents who had to either miss 2 weeks of work or find some sort of a daycare or health care, which obviously is not cheap.
When did the skepticism about vaccines start arising?
You mean the fear related to autism? Or?
Yeah, I think the autism is the most pointed concern. When did this start popping up?
The first time there was a connection between autism and vaccines was really proposed was in the late 90s, 1998, when this British researcher named Andrew Wakefield published a paper in which he and his co-authors said that they had identified a possible connection between the measles virus and therefore the measles vaccine and a gut disorder, and then between that gut disorder and autism. And before that, there had been plenty of concerns about whether or not autism caused developmental disorders, but nothing specifically related to autism. And then the year after that, in 1999, in the U.S., there was a controversy involving a mercury-based preservative called Dimerosal. And again, there was no discussion or concern or anything previous to that about a connection between that and autism, but a group of parent activists sort of identified that as something they were very concerned with. So it's now been about, you know, a dozen years since the whole sort of autism scare has first came up.
And this Wakefield fellow is very much the center of this, right? He's been recently revealed as something of a litigation entrepreneur, hasn't he?
What has come out in the years since he initially published that paper, one of the things that has come out is that at the time that he published the paper, he had a financial relationship with a lawyer or a solicitor in the UK who was working with parents who believed their children had been injured by vaccines, which is and would be obviously a big conflict of interest. So that's the main thing concerning litigation and his potential litigation with vaccines. He's also been a very major figure, mainly because of his theories, but a major figure in a lot of U.S. cases, court cases involving autism and vaccines. But as far as I know, the main litigation he was actually involved with was in the U.K.
Now, what's the scientific status of his research? I don't think he's had much confirmation of his work, has he?
No, his work was, well, the interesting thing about his work is even that first paper that he studied was only based on a 12-child case series, which really is never the type of study that you would base any conclusions on. You would use it as a potential avenue for more investigations. You know, it wouldn't necessarily be surprising if those results were not confirmed in the future, because that happens all the time with case series. What happened is that he went much further in his public comments than he did in the paper itself regarding how we should interpret it and what we should do about it. And he immediately recommended that parents stop giving their children the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. In the years since then, there have been dozens and dozens of efforts both to replicate his results on an individual level, so to find children in which what he described as having to find children in which that could be replicated, and also looking at epidemiological studies to try and identify whether this is happening on a population level. and there has never been any independent successful effort to confirm any of that. And in fact, over the years, there have been more and more revelations about his data. He initially said that those children that were in the study were consecutively referred. In other words, they just happened to be 12 children who came in a row to his clinic. It turns out that was not true. Some of these children were funneled to him by this lawyer that he was working with. It also turned out that he had taken out a patent for an alternate measles vaccine shortly before he published the paper. So not only was there never any successful effort to reproduce his work, but there have been numerous reasons why we should be skeptical of the initial work.
Speaking with Seth Manukin, who is the author of The Panic Virus from Simon & Schuster, let's talk a little bit about the scientific methods involved in approaching these issues. You've mentioned this case study, which is several steps above anecdotal data. It's not rigorous. It's just examination of cases, which could be interesting and suggestive, but not really conclusive. There are population studies, which you mentioned, and then, of course, double-blind clinical trial kinds of studies. So just talk about the other methods of approaching this issue and how they're relevant to the vaccine story.
Well, the interesting thing about case studies, and I think it's something that, one of the big issues I tried to get into is the ways in which we, meaning, journalists and information purveyors, communicate science, especially to the public. And a case series in the scientific world is something that everyone knows and has always known is never the type of thing you would draw conclusions from, because there are any number of reasons why you might be seeing something on a very small level. Most of the time, that's just random noise. It's just coincidence. And one of the examples I use in the book is, I'm sure most of us know large families with 8 or 10 or 12 children. And a case series is really the equivalent of looking at that family, and if there are, 7 boys and 3 girls, concluding then that 70% of the population is male. And that's even if, Wakefield's initial study there hadn't been all of these other problems with his research and potential conflicts of interest and now accusations of fraud, you still would never draw any sort of conclusions from a case series. What you would then do if you did have a case series that you thought showed something interesting, you would then look for ways that you could confirm that more reliably. And one thing you could do is do an epidemiological study, so take a larger slice of the population and run the numbers on that. And obviously, if you ran the numbers on a city or a state or anything, you would find that 70% of the population is not male in that case. If you were doing a study in which you were looking for a potential connection between two phenomena, so in this case, between autism and vaccines, one type of study you could do is to engineer a population so that half of the people get vaccinated or receive the treatment that is being investigated and half don't, and then look at what the results from there are. Obviously, with vaccines, that's not something you can do because you're talking about a potentially life-saving intervention. So what we have been able to do instead is in places in which there are reliable and extensive health records, and especially in Denmark and Sweden, where they keep very good health records and the vaccination program is exclusively run by the state, you can then go back and look at vaccinated children and unvaccinated children. And again, in this case, compare rates of autism. There are all sorts of different sort of levels of proof and types of experiments that one can do. And, one of the things that I think is so kind of disturbing, I guess, about the way this story has evolved is I think from very early on, a lot of this was just so avoidable because we should have, our industry, we journalists, should have realized from the get-go when he held this press conference that it was absolutely nuts to be making widespread conclusions from a 12-person case series. And I think if the coverage starting in 1998 had not been along the lines of prominent researcher says vaccines might cause autism, other people disagree. If that had not been the tenor of the coverage from the get-go, the whole story might have evolved very, very differently.
The population studies you refer to have found no evidence at all that the vaccines lead to autism, right?
Yes, no, that's absolutely right. And there have been studies looking at the MMR vaccine, studies looking at vaccines in total, studies looking specifically at vaccines that had this mercury-based preservative called thimerosal. And I say had because it's been removed from vaccines now for a decade. And no, there's never been any reliable research indicating at all that there was any connection between vaccines and autism. And I think one of the real tragedies of the way in which this has both seized the public attention and become a real political issue is that we've now spent an enormous amount of time and money and research effort replicating these and repeating these same studies about vaccines again and again and again, because a lot of people who believe that most fervently are not satisfied with the results indicating that there is no connection. So, as I said before, we still don't know a lot about what causes autism. And in my mind, we've lost years of time and millions of dollars that we could have spent looking into other potential environmental triggers, looking into better ways to have early intervention, better treatment options. So at this point, I think it's an issue that has really been, it would be impossible to address it in more completeness or more depth.
But of course, the media love this idea that there are two sides to the story, even though they're really, scientifically speaking, are not two sides to the story. There's a way in which the heartbreaking situation that parents are in, and God knows it's very heartbreaking, becomes more compelling than any number of scientific researchers could be. We also see these kinds of this kind of bogus sense of balance, two sides to the story, on other issues like global warming, even though you know this is really not an open scientific question, really. Is there any way to address this structural problem that the media have when covering issues like this?
Well, I mean, I really think there needs to be a sort of institutional discussion about what it means to cover science responsibly. I know that's not something that a lot of people are very optimistic about occurring, and I guess I understand why that is. But I don't think it's impossible, and my first book was about a series of scandals at the New York Times that occurred in 2002 and 2003. And in a very short amount of time after that, there really was a culture shift, not just at the New York Times, but in media institutions generally regarding responsiveness to readers or viewers or listeners. And now the notion of having a reader representative or a listener representative, you know, an ombudsman of some sort, is really the norm at a lot of places. And I think people expect to be able to voice their concerns about accuracy and have places respond. So I don't think it's impossible to have a sort of institutional conversation, institutional meaning not just one newspaper, but across the entire industry, about the consequences of poor coverage and ways in which we can be better about covering these issues. Science and health and medicine is really, in some ways, it's unique in the type of bad reporting that we accept. I'll give you an example. If I told you right now Boeing is about to buy GM, and I know this just because I have secret information, and then you went and called Boeing and called GM, and everyone said, no, that's totally ridiculous, you wouldn't run with that story. You know, you would be embarrassed. Anyone who went with that story would be embarrassed, and their peers would ridicule them. They would have a hard time getting other jobs. Their audience wouldn't trust them. But for some reason, when it comes to science, a lot of times that story would then end up, you know, well, this person says Boeing is about to buy GM, and all of these people say that that's not true. And because, of course, you can't interview or you can't, you know, run the opinions of 1,000 or 1,000,000 or 100,000,000 people in a news story. What you get is, you know, one person on each side, essentially. And it sets up this false equivalency, this on the one hand, on the other hand, that I think is very troubling in a lot of cases, in cases where there really aren't two hands. And I think this has become one of those cases, and we've seen the effects of it.
And in the last couple of minutes we've got, I want to talk a little bit about what you call medical NIMBYism, the consequences on the rest of the population of the decision of some not to vaccinate their children. Is this really a personal matter, or is it actually put other people at risk?
Well, you know, I'm not someone, but I just don't feel comfortable sort of making prescriptive recommendations about the best way to deal with something from a legal perspective. Or so, you know, I've been asked, well, should there be different laws about school age vaccination, you know, et cetera. And I really don't know about that. What I do think, and I think this and I feel this very, very strongly, is that it is not honest. It is dishonest and really wrong for parents to say, I'm not going to vaccinate my child, and that's just an individual choice. And if you believe in vaccines, you vaccinate your child, and then you don't need to worry about it. But this is something I'm doing, and it doesn't affect anyone else. It's just absolutely untrue. First of all, there are children who are unable to receive vaccines for any number of reasons, and those children are obviously going to be at risk if someone around them catches one of those diseases. Second of all, vaccines are not 100% effective. The same with everything, the same way seatbelts aren't 100% effective. And I have talked to families whose children got incredibly sick, and one family in Minnesota whose their daughter caught HIB and was put in a medically induced coma and lost all motor function, and that child had been vaccinated and only discovered that vaccine was not effective when she actually caught HIB. Also, obviously, the infants, they don't get fully immunized at birth. So the period in which they are most vulnerable to catching these diseases is also the period in which their bodies are least equipped to deal with it. So for a parent to tell themselves and to tell other people, you know, this is just a personal decision I'm making, I have very little patience for that. If parents are going to make that decision, I think it is very important that they be honest with themselves about the possible repercussions of that. And like I said before, 10 infants died of whooping cough last year in California. 9 of them were under 6 months old, which means they weren't yet old enough to have been fully vaccinated. I'm not going to tell people what they should or shouldn't do, but I do think it's very important that people not lie to themselves about the possible consequences of their actions.
That was Seth Mnookin, author of The Panic Virus, A True Story of Medicine, Science, and Fear, published by Simon & Schuster. Mnookin, by the way, is spelled M-N-O-O-K-I-N. Mnookin, M-N-O-O-K-I-N. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web at kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, the program Behind the News. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to hear from the late Bob Fitch.
Shall I?
the Kinks doing part of Get Back Into Line. It doesn't express my view of unions, of course, but it is a popular view, and for some of the reasons that Bob Fitch will tell us about in a few minutes. Before that, though, some words on Fitch, who died on March 4th at the age of 72. This is based on the draft of a piece I'm doing for the Nation's website. It should be up next week. I met Bob Fitch sometime in the late 1980s. He was just resurfacing after several years underground. A major publisher had given him a big advance to write a book about New York City, and he found it impossible to deliver. Bob delisted his phone number, gave up writing for union organizing, and tried to keep the collection agents at bay. After a few years of self-imposed exile, he was resurfacing at the Village Voice, and half of the Nation's current London office, Don Guttenplan, introduced me to him. I just read Bob's fantastic essay, Planning New York, in a now-out-of-print collection about the urban crisis. It was about the 1929 plan for New York City drawn up by the Regional Plan Association. It laid out the auto-centered metropolitan region, including the highway system that would later be attributed to Robert Moses. What impressed me about the piece was that it detailed just how precisely planned by elites over the very long term the physical and social evolution of New York City has been. Bob had developed these themes in his later writings, notably The Assassination of New York, published in 1996, in which he recounted the history of Wall Street and the real estate elite's planned deindustrialization of the city and its transformation into the prototype of a globally oriented post-industrial metropolis. One of the major points of the book is that this was not a natural evolution, but something that was quite consciously planned. Fitch was also doing a lot of writing about the corruption and compromises of the American union movement, stolen elections, stolen money, sweatshops with a union label, all of which later led to his last book, Solidarity for Sale, published in 2006. Now let's listen to some excerpts from an interview I did with Bob on my old WBAI show in February 2006, when the book had just come out. Some of this material might sound a little out of date, but most won't. As you can hear in the interview, Bob Fitch was an uncompromising truth-teller. He viewed the Democratic Party and American unions as a political dead end for any sort of serious radical politics. People who enter these institutions with the hope of transforming them find instead the institutions assimilate them and turn them to pillars of the status quo. For saying things like this, Bob was ostracized by academia and labor. Although his material situation improved somewhat in recent years, he lived most of his life on very little money. As Don Guttenplan, the former Village Voice editor who introduced me to Bob, wrote me earlier this week, it's a scandal that they scraped the barrel to give these so-called genius grants to third-rate conventional fakers when Bob Fitch, a man who did his own thinking and his own research, and who came up with truly original insights about some pretty important topics, urban planning, organized labor, critical journalism, had to live like a Luftmensch. As I said, this interview was first broadcast in 2006. It may sound like the beginning is a little abrupt. That's because it was kind of joined already in progress. This interview was broadcast as part of a fundraising special, so you're going to hear some telephones ringing in the background. Please forgive that and the occasional anachronism. All right, Bob Fitch.
Let me just open by playing off that opening image. Reagan fired the air traffic controllers. There are many explanations for the weakness of organized labor in the United States, individualism of American culture, the strength of the American ruling class, state repression of the sort symbolized in peaceful form by Reagan's firing of Patco and then less peaceful form 80 and 100 years ago by armed guards firing on strikers. All of these things are part of the story, but you also foreground that great unspoken aspect of American labor history, the deep corruption of so many of our unions. How do all these things stack up in your view? How important is corruption in explaining the weakness of the American labor movement relative to all those other things I just was listing?
I think that it's profoundly important. If you understand corruption not as some personal evil, but as an inherent structural feature of American unions going back to the 19th century. Early on, American unions were like unions everywhere, which is to say that you had workers who were able to capture a particular niche of the economy, like maybe they were iron workers or carpenters or longshoremen or teamsters, and they could mess things up and control that space and force the boss to deal with them and get a little monopoly. And then you hire your relatives and your friends and do some business with the boss. That was pretty much what unionism was in the West until the turn of the 20th century. The difference between America and in Europe is that in America, our unions, although challenged by more inclusive forms of labor unions, the challenges never really succeeded. Whereas in Europe, they went on to form much more comprehensive, non-monopoly, non-boss-client type unions that were much more of a threat to the boss and required a lot more concessions than anything we were able to achieve in America, except for very rare periods of social movement unionism.
You say in the you point out in the book that even in Italy, home of the mafia, they've never seen anything like the pervasive influence of organized crime on unions that we have here. And this goes back well before the time of Jimmy Hoffa. Why? Well, is this just another version of American exceptionalism? What left American unions so vulnerable to the kinds of corruption you write about?
Italians from southern Italy had to come here in order to be able to control unions. In the laborers in Chicago, the first laborers local, which still exists today and is still in trouble for mob influence, it was founded by Big Jim Colosimo, who was Al Capone's predecessor. Big Jim controlled the prostitutes in the crib, and he controlled the labor unions, and he controlled the numbers. And he was able to install his goombas in the different locals in the city. And from Chicago, they spread out and wound up controlling the entire laborers' union. And it's probably still heavily influenced by organized crime today. And I would suggest, Doug, that the reason why America is so different is because it was underdeveloped. And it never got to the second stage of mass unionism, where the unions are not based on exclusive bargaining and monopolizing a territory, but they become national unions, and people get to choose which union they want to join, whether they want to be in a communist union, a Catholic union, a socialist union, and you pay dues voluntarily. This is not what happens in America. We're stuck at what is called the trade union level of development, by and large. The CIO unions never really realized the promise that people thought they would. When most lefties think of American unionism, they think of the CIO. They think of the auto workers. They think of the steel workers as American unionism. But if you count noses, what you see is that if you took all those CIO unions that were big in the 1930s, the steel workers and the auto workers and the coal miners, you could fit them all in the Teamsters today, or in the United Food and Commercial Workers, or in SEIU. And that kind of industrial mass unionism, which in itself deteriorated very badly, became bureaucratized and then became corrupt, a lot like the old AFL unions. But still, that challenge was turned back, and the AFL unions, which were then heavily mafia-dominated, managed to beat the CIO unions in their phalanxes of Reds and Socialists and mass movement.
Well, what was the unions. Contribution of the McCarthyite purge in the late 50s, late 40s, early 50s?
I think it's a lot less than what people want to argue. I think that people want to make the egress of the CP into the defining factor of the weakness of American unionism. But you can see that the CIO had been beaten in the streets by the AFL.
You mean literally beaten?
Literally beaten, yeah. There was something that I call the Capone International, which was the Teamsters and the laborers and a bunch of unions made up of very, very tough guys who actually engaged in armed struggles with CIO people in the streets of various American cities. Detroit was one example. Minneapolis was another. Los Angeles was another. And they won. They won the physical battles. And I think a lot of the reason why they won is because of J. Edgar Hoover. J. Edgar Hoover insisted all throughout the 30s and the 40s that there was no mafia to the late 50s. And that the communists represented the big threat to American security. And as a consequence, he went after the CIO, but he never went after the mobbed up, violent, corrupt AFL unions.
And I think a lot of people who are listening may think of union corruption as going back to the legendary Jimmy Hoffa and his disappearance at the end zone of a giant stadium, wherever it is he ended up. But you go way back into the early 20th century with this history of deep and pervasive corruption. A fellow named Sam Parks. Tell us about Sam Parks.
Sam Parks was with the iron workers, and when he was at his peak, he was a guy that would be mentioned in the same breath as John D. Rockefeller and J.P. Morgan as one of the makers and shakers of urban society. Lincoln Steffens, the famous muckraker, talks about him in those terms. But he was head of the iron workers in New York. And the iron workers were a very powerful construction union that, because of their muscle and violence, was able to control big high-rise construction projects here downtown. And Sam Parks was a guy that you had to be on his good side if you were a contractor, or he would shut the job down. If you were a member and you didn't do what he said, he would knock you out. He boasted once that he had over 20 fights in one day. And he was one of the paradigm labor czars of the United States labor movement, who rose to the top because he could swing his fists and stayed there because he was capable of satisfying the need of contractors for cheap labor and labor peace, and a selected group of men whom he favored who would get all the best jobs and work inside when it was cold and work steady throughout the year. So they supported him no matter what.
And you alluded to something there about the importance of labor peace, offering contractors, employers, labor peace. And this is something you write about in the book as being common in more recent history, or unions like Unite, which are highly regarded in some circles as offering sweetheart deals. So tell us a bit about that.
Well, I think Unite is an example not of a particularly corrupt union, although it's certainly been that throughout the years, but a union that is understood not like the Teamsters, the laborers, the longshoremen as a corrupt union, but as a kind of living, breathing social democracy that has advanced the well-being of immigrants. And however true that was at the in the first couple of decades of the 20th century, and then again for a time in the 30s and the 40s, it certainly hasn't been true for the last 30 or 40 years. It certainly hasn't been true in New York City with the latest waves of Latino and Asian, particularly Chinese garment workers, who have been laboring for subminimum wages, who don't really have any health care, who retire after 25 or 30 years on an average 67.
These are union workers you're talking about.
Yeah. There's really very little difference in New York City between union workers who have a contract and are supposed to be paying, being paid $11, $12 an hour, but who are actually making the minimum wage and not getting any benefits, and non-union workers who are getting sub-minimum wage and not getting any benefits.
And of course, some people might hear that and say, but what choice do they have? They have Chinese, there's competition from Chinese workers who get 10 cents an hour, so how can we possibly maintain even a 5-15 wage against that kind of foreign competition?
Well, but then they have to deal with the fact that there are non-union employers that are paying 13. They have to face the same 10-cent an hour worker in China. Why aren't they being dragged down? Why are Italian garment workers making two or three times what American workers are making and exporting clothes to us? They export over $1 billion worth of clothes to the United States, and they have higher wages. I think to answer that, you have to look at the history of the industry and the strategy that union giants like David Dubinsky executed, which was to maintain piecework, to maintain the contracting system, and to try to compete with the non-union sector across the country by lowering wages. They were very successful at lowering wages, but they weren't successful in keeping the industry.
That is the voice of Bob Fitch, Robert Fitch, more formally, author of the book Solidarity for Sale, a story of how corruption destroyed the labor movement in the United States I said something about this just before the break, Bob. You know, a lot of people may listen and say, why should I really care? Unions have been arrogant and insidery. They're much more interested in the welfare of their members or their leaders than the general public and the working class. And, you know, they just sort of, a lot of other people might think they're a bunch of leftovers from a different era. We don't really need them anymore. Why should people... the, what is it, 88% of the American workforce not represented by unions care about all this?
Yeah, I think that the special interest argument has seeped in from its natural source on the right and infected the left so that we don't understand the source of our weakness. I think that the crucial fact that has to be understood is the necessity of countervailing power. If you have a huge, powerful, intelligent corporate sector and there's nothing in their way, if there's no countervailing source of power, they're going to be able to get what they want. They're going to be able to drive wages. They're going to be able to set the legal framework for pensions and health care. And they're going to project everything they do as a matter of economic necessity. And nobody's going to be able to say anything different. On the other hand, if there is a massive, well-organized, democratic, public-spirited labor movement that can oppose them, outcomes are going to be very different. Outcomes will resemble those in Europe a lot more than here. And I think that if we just do a checklist of what the Europeans have and we don't have, we can see some of the costs of countervailing power, that our lack of it and what we're paying. We work on the average of 200 to 300 hours a year more than the Europeans. We don't have any legally mandated vacations in America. I mean, your boss may give you 2 weeks or 3 weeks or even 4 weeks, but there's nothing that says that you have to have a certain number of weeks vacation every year. Every European country has a law like that. We have no universal health insurance, as many of the listeners know, here in the United States. All the European countries have that. We don't have free universal higher education in European countries have that. I think that when you look at how these great gains were won in Europe, you can see that the labor movement played the preponderant role. Either the labor movement or socialist parties on their own, or, as in the case of Germany going back to the 1880s, Bismarck's desire to compete with the socialists and beat them to the punch on health insurance, which is why Germany became the first country to have health insurance. They had the biggest labor movement.
It almost makes me nostalgic for the day when there was an interest in co-opting reforms.
Right.
Well, let me zero in on something you mentioned there, the fight for universal health insurance, public health insurance. And I've often wondered why the U.S. labor movement has been so absent in this struggle. This has been a live political issue, well, goes back decades, but...
people aren't aware how many... It really goes back to the World War I.
Yeah, but it was certainly revived as a political issue in the early 1990s, and the U.S. labor movement was largely missing in action from this. And now we see GM and the auto industry on the ropes, and in part because of massive health care costs that they don't have, that competitors don't have to worry about in other countries. You would think this would be a perfect time for the UAW to lead a fight for some kind of national health insurance program. Why are they missing an action on this one?
I think that of all the unions, probably one of the least culpable is the United Auto Workers. But I wouldn't give them too much credit. The real problem as far as American labor unions lining up on the wrong side is that American labor unions, not all of them, not the UAW, have their own plans that they find very advantageous to administer. If you administer your health plan, there's two valuable dimensions. One is that you can put a lot of your people in as the staff, as the administrators of those plans. And the other...
So that's a classic political patronage operation.
Exactly. And the other notch up in the corruption chain is that you're in a powerful position to decide who is going to be the vendors for those planes. Who are going to be the dentists? Who is going to be the pharmaceutical benefit manager, incredibly lucrative position, decides which drugs the members are going to buy and how much they're going to pay. Nobody knows how much drugs are going to pay, and whoever has that job, it's a fortune. And the kickbacks that you can get from that are tremendous. Or you can do what crime families in New York do, which is create their own pharmaceutical benefit manager organizations, and then get their labor union flunkies to hire their firms.
The Service Employees Union, which in many circles is regarded highly, the SEIU, run by Andy Stern, has a healthcare initiative, and I was reading their platform yesterday, and I was amazed at what weak mush it is. And you would think that, given the reputation of Stern and the SEIU for fresh thinking and bold stances, that they would be in the forefront of leading for half their members work in the healthcare field. You think that they might actually be in the lead for pressing for some kind of national health scheme. Why are they missing in action?
I think that you can understand the position of practically every union in this country if you simply look at what's in their self-interest. Look at the benefits they get from running their own plans, and look at the signals that their employers are giving them as far as healthcare options are concerned. For example, the UAW has been guided by General Motors, you know, going back to the 60s, to be for a national health insurance plan. Top executives of the automobile industry, like Iacocca, have been for a national health insurance plan. So they feel very confident in doing what the employers want and doing what is in the interest of lots of us, which is being for national health insurance. In the case of the Service Employees International Union and Andy Stern, I think that the healthcare industry basically is for the status quo, does not want to be nationalized, does not want a single-payer plan. And I think that they, in this respect, as in so many others, tend to do what the industry leaders want.
And that's the voice of Bob Fitch, author of the book Solidarity for Sale. We've only got a few minutes left. What is to be done? This is the question I always leave for the last 2 minutes. But what, in rough outline, does the American labor movement need to get off its back?
I think that we need to think in terms of two kinds of reforms, Doug. One kind, call it inside-the-box reforms, would attempt to deal with the reality of American labor unions that are weak, fragmented, and corrupt, and are simply run by too many people who are hiring their brother-in-law. There are too many of them, they make too much money, and they're too little accountable to the membership. We've been trying for 100 years to change that. I think that we need some basic principles in order to make that work better, if it's possible at all. I think we should make union leadership a sacrifice and not a sinecure. Why should these people not be subjected to term limits? Why should they make so many more times what the members make? I think reforms along those lines, consolidating unions, making the unions more responsible to members, I think that that would help. But I don't think by any means it would solve the problem. What we really need to do is to think about a more advanced model. We need to look at the best practice of labor unions elsewhere, and we would see that they don't look anything like the unions that we have. We need to think about unions that are much less close to the employer and much more responsible to the membership. We need to think about unions that are able to act in a national space and are able to bargain with employers at the highest level and are not interested in simply doing favors for employers at low levels, exchanging favors with low-level contractors, which is the stock and trade of our American unions. To do that, we have to deal with the fundamental characteristics of the union contract as it's negotiated all across America. The fundamental feature of the American union contract is exclusive bargaining. In other words, I'm a boss. I'm only going to deal with you, this one union, no matter what, forever. This initial contract is something that becomes the basis for negotiation for eternity, and workers who come after can never do anything about it except going through this very difficult process of decertification. We need to do something about exclusive bargaining and move towards a European model where several unions can represent workers and they can work together and go on strikes together, even general strikes, which I think the last general strike we had in America was in 1877. In Europe, they happen all the time because they have national unions. There's no way we could even – we tried to have a transit strike in New York City a couple of months ago, and the fragmentation of our labor movement exploded in our face. It was a very well-supported strike by large sections of the public, but it wasn't supported by the international of the union that was carrying it out. They sabotaged it. Practically every important labor leader in New York City advised the head of the transit workers to go back to work. The upshot was that they did.
That was my old friend Bob Fitch, who died on March 4 at the age of 72. I'd fallen out of touch with him in recent years and had recently resolved to get back in touch with him. Whenever someone dies, I'm reminded that we should all carpe diem. And with Bob's death, I'm reminded that you should never let those old ties fray either. Let's remember Bob Fitch with his funeral march from Scriabin's first piano sonata performed by Ruth Laredo. Bob once said to me that the bourgeoisie does a very poor job of taking care of its high culture. I guess we'll have to do that work for them. Till next week. Bye.